I'm Afua Hirsch.
I'm Peter Frankopan.
And in our podcast, Legacy, we explore the lives of some of the biggest characters in history.
This season, we're exploring the life of Cleopatra.
An iconic life full of romances, sieges, and tragedy. But who was the real Cleopatra? It feels like her story's been told by others with their own agenda for centuries.
But her legacy is enduring, and so we're going to dive into how her story has evolved all the way up to today.
I am so excited to talk about Cleopatra, Peter.
Love Cleopatra.
She is an icon.
She's the most famous woman in antiquity. It's got to be up there with the most famous woman of all time.
But I think there's a huge gap between how familiar people are with the idea of her compared to what they actually know about her life and character.
So for pyramids, Cleopatra and Cleopatra's nose.
Follow Legacy now wherever you get your podcasts. Or you can binge entire seasons early and ad-free on Wondery Plus.
Hello everyone, welcome to Dan Snow's History Hit. I am in South Africa, I've just climbed Table Mountain on the way to a special History Hit project that you're going to be hearing about soon. And I thought I'd rest up halfway through the journey with a little ascent of Table Mountain, a beautiful thing. Looking down on the azure waters of the Atlantic, Robben Island, where Nelson Mandela was kept prisoner. The Castle of Good Hope, built by the Dutch. The fort, now lying at the heart of Cape Town. What a historic city. Lying beneath me as I climbed up. This podcast does have something to do with South Africa because this podcast is a conversation with Saul David, Professor of Military History at the University of Buckingham, a best-selling author, legendary broadcaster, TV presenter. And we talked about the Zulu Wars, a book he wrote years ago, but a subject that has continued to define his career and gain him plaudits. And we talked about the remarkable Anglo-Zulu War that was raging this month in 1879. One of the most famous defeats and one of the most famous victories in British history, as you'll hear about coming up. This podcast will be broadcast on History Hit TV. It's the new digital history channel. You can go over there. You use the code POD6, P-O-D-6. Very straightforward. You get an offer no one else has access to. Only podcast listeners have access to this offer. You use the code POD6. You get 6 weeks for free. You can watch our recent documentary on the streets of Birmingham with Carl Chin, talking about the reality of the Peaky Blinders story, who those men were, what they were really like. You can go on there. You can watch anything, in fact. You can watch hundreds of hours of documentary. If you use the code POD6, you get 6 weeks free. And between you and me, you can watch the whole thing in 6 weeks. I mean, you can sail across the Atlantic with Christopher Columbus in 6 weeks and discover the New World. You can invade Normandy in 1944 and decisively defeat the German armies in northwest France in 6 weeks. There's a lot that you can do in 6 weeks. You can do a lot of living in 6 weeks. So use the code POD6. Get 6 weeks free of History Hit. Enjoy it. You can watch Saul David, lots of other stuff. But before you do any of that, peer is the man himself, talking about the Anglo-Zulu War. Enjoy. Saul David, Mr. Zulu War, welcome. Why did Britain find itself fighting the Zulus in the 1870s?
Good question, because officially the British government had no intention of fighting the Zulus. And the timing is important. 1879, towards the end of 1878, early 1879, which is where most of the tension in South Africa that leads to the start of the war is building up. And the proconsul in South Africa is warning the British government that there may be trouble ahead. British government, meanwhile, is saying to him, whatever you do, we don't want a war in South Africa. Why? Because they're already fighting one in Afghanistan, which has broken out. And frankly, the Afghanistan war, which, of course, was fought chiefly to prevent Russian influence there, is, as far as we're concerned, in strategic terms, far more important. So this relatively minor war against a warlike nation, but a nation that we didn't really see as a serious threat to us strategically in southern Africa, was something the British government wanted to avoid. So you might ask the question, why did we fight it? Well, we fought it because the proconsul out there, a man called Sir Bartle Frere, had been sent to South Africa with one job, which is to confederate the various British colonies that existed there, Natal and Cape Province, but also the Boer republics, if he could, and they were going through the process of attempting to take over those Boer republics, but also any native, any African, black African polities that might get in the way. Now, this didn't specifically mean that Zululand had to be taken over, but they had to be wary that it could cause a problem. But the exact timing, as I've already explained, was one that the British government were not interested in fighting a war there because they were already fighting in Afghanistan. But Bartle Frere had other intentions. And the reason he was able to get away with making his own decisions is because of this time gap that you had in the late 19th century between information coming from London and getting to South Africa. 3-4 week journey for messages to get there, even by steamship. There was a telegraph part of the way, but it didn't go the whole way. So he was able to use this time gap really to ignore official instructions and to effectively launch a war of aggression against the Zulus.
And the Zulus have been sort of mythologized as this incredibly martial empire. How much of that is true? What was the nature of kind of Zulu society?
It was very militarized. A lot of it is true. They've been described as the Black Spartans, and I think that's pretty accurate, actually. It's interesting that the original Zulu tribe was only relatively small size towards the end of the 18th century. And I suppose, as a lot of people know, the key figure in the rise of the Zulu nation, which was really a question of dominating the tribes around them and subsuming them into this greater Zulu empire, I suppose you would call it, was Shaka, one of the early kings. And what he did is develop a new military system which completely revolutionized warfare in southern Africa. Prior to Shaka taking control of the Zulu nation, tribes would often fight each other in southern Africa, but rarely to the death, as it were. They would make a bit of a show. One or two people might be killed. One side would give in and the other side would take over. You'd take a few captives. But it was, I'm exaggerating a little bit, but it was relatively benign. This war of destruction that the Zulus became very adept at was the brainchild of Shaka. And he created a new method of fighting, not only new weapons, the short stabbing spear, the assegai, ikwa, as it was known, very bad pronunciation, I'm sure. But to use this short stabbing spear, you had to close with the enemy. And so he devised tactics, the so-called horns of the buffalo, in which you would surround your enemy and annihilate them. Not unlike, interestingly enough, the tactics of the Roman legions. And it's quite interesting, when I was working on my Zulu book, I thought to myself, could there be any link between what the Romans had used and the Zulus? And clearly, it's hard to see one, and yet the tactics are so similar, from literally down to the throwing of the spears at the beginning of the battle in the same way that the Romans would throw their javelins, to closing and using the short implement to annihilate the opponent. And that's pretty much what the Zulus became very good at. And as a result, they took over an enormous swathe of southern Southeast Africa.
And what, in terms of their development as a state, are they in danger of competing with the European polities down there?
Well, that was the perception. Interestingly enough, up until 1879, they'd pretty much been, peace with the Zulus. That wasn't to say that the Zulus were peaceful among themselves and other tribes in the region, but it was to say that they recognised that the British were an existential threat and they'd better keep on their side. So, yes, there were one or two border incursions which were exaggerated and used for benefit of the British to justify, I suppose, the war. But if we're being honest, you'd have to say, was it likely that even a confederation of southern Africa would have put up with such a dangerous organized military force on it, right on its border? Probably not in the long term. But the decision to deal with the problem in 1879, when the Zulus had no intention of going to war with the British, was the decision taken by Bartle Frere alone.
So the war of aggression begins. A British force moves in, a little bit arrogant.
Very arrogant. arrogance, underestimation of the enemy, poor reconnaissance, an unwillingness to take, even minor precautions. So what lies behind all of this? Well, very much a feeling that we had the edge over them in terms of technology, which was true. We had some very good firearms, breech-loading firearms at that time. But it's also a numbers game, and we weren't going to put anything like the same number of troops in the field. So our best hope of defeating the Zulus was by getting them to fight on our terms. Lord Chelmsford, the British commander, makes one big mistake. He's fought a war just a year earlier against the Cape Frontier tribes. And it was really a question of trying to find these guys because they played ambush and run tactics. And it was really difficult to pin them down for some reason. And it's hard to know what that reason was, Dan, because he had a lot of intelligence from people who knew how the Zulus fought and explained to him what they were going to do. He thought it was going to be similar in Zululand. It's a question of finding them and bringing them to battle, not a question of making sure we don't get taken by surprise. And so when Chelmsford, with the central column, his plan is to invade by multiple different directions. But he originally thinks there are going to be five columns. In reality, only three cross the border. The plan is for all those three columns to meet at Ulundi, the Zulu capital. And Chelmsford is pretty confident that the Zulus are not going to take on any of these columns before then. Why? We'll never know, because Zulu tactics are aggressive. They can march an awful long distance in a relatively short period of time. They can go from one bit of the country to another and take you by surprise in very short order. And why Chelmsford had managed to convince himself that they won't fight and we need to winkle them out, we'll never know for sure. But that undoubtedly, that was his conviction. And so not only did he invade with an inadequate force of about 5,000 soldiers in his central column, he then makes the double mistake of splitting it and marching off with part of it on a wild goose chase based on some very faulty intelligence to try and track the Zulus down. Meanwhile, the Zulus are in a completely different place. That is the main Zulu impi, the main Zulu army. And it's got its eyes on the camp he's left behind with about 1,700 soldiers defending it at Islanwana. So we get the first cataclysmic battle of the war on the 22nd of January, 1879, just 11 days after Chelmsford's crossed the border.
And it's one of the great defeats in British, but also European colonial history.
Yeah. You know, we could think of three or four that might compare: the retreat from Kabul in 1842, the Battle of Maywand in Afghanistan, which will take place a year later. Adowa, I suppose, the Italians against the Ethiopians towards the end of the century, and Islanwana, and that's it. This is a cataclysmic defeat because it was unexpected, because the Zulus take no prisoners, and pretty much everyone they caught in that camp is butchered because of the way they open the belly so that the ritual disembowelment of their enemies, which was for spiritual reasons rather than an atrocity per se, but nevertheless, you can imagine when you come across a battlefield in which people have been butchered in that way, it's a pretty horrific sight, albeit it took the British almost 2 or 3 months to get back to the battlefield. So terrified were they. And Chelmsford is quaking in his boots after this battle for two reasons. One, because he suddenly realizes that the Zulus are a serious proposition. And two, because he's terrified he's going to lose his job.
Is it a night attack they make on the British camp?
It's very early in the morning. So they've hidden in a valley about 4 or 5 miles away the night before. They're waiting there. Can you imagine the discipline? 20,000 Zulu warriors hiding in this valley, this hidden valley. Now, if Chelmsford had done his job, he'd have had scouts out all over the place and they would have noticed this, but he didn't. Overconfidence. They had pickets out around the camp itself at Islanwana, but not that far away. There'd been some very dubious scouting done. As I've already mentioned, he was given faulty intelligence. So while that impi is hiding in that staying overnight in that valley, he actually leaves the camp that same night going on this wild goose chase. He's already sent out an initial force. He's told that initial force has engaged some Zulus. Actually, it was only a relatively small force of Zulus. To this day, we're not certain, the historians aren't certain, whether or not this was a deliberate fake by the Zulus. A lot of people believe it was. It might have been. The sources are a little scanty on this. But what is not in doubt is that they managed to divide not only once but twice this army, so that, as I've already said, 1,700 soldiers are waiting in the camp. And what's significant about those 1,700 soldiers is about 1,000 of them are British troops and the other 700 are a mixture of colonial troops and African auxiliaries. And some of the latter do not put up the toughest fight. Probably not surprisingly, actually, because they're very poorly armed and they're up against their mortal enemies who are in enormous numbers.
This is After Dark: Myths, Misdeeds, and the Paranormal.
The podcast that takes you to the shadiest corners of the past, unpicking history's spookiest, strangest, and most sinister stories. I'm Maddie Pelling.
And I'm Anthony Delaney. Join us every Monday and Thursday, and we'll take a look at the darker side of history, from haunted pubs to Houdini to witch trials and arsenic-laced breakfasts.
Follow After Dark: Myths, Misdeeds, and the Paranormal wherever you get your podcasts. Brought to you by History Hit.
And so that it's a battle, but I mean it's pretty quick, is it?
There is a moment during the battle where they almost hold out. I think the key to the battle is the fact that the British send out their defensive position too far away from the camp. What they should have done is lagered the camp, used the wagons they had. They had enormous numbers of wagons there. They should have lagered and used that as a fortress. But of course, they're taken by surprise. They don't expect the attack. The attack takes them completely by surprise. And by that time, other interesting thing about the battle, the tactics they use for the battle are tactics which have been prescribed by Chelmsford at the beginning of the war, which is that you're to send your infantry a certain distance away from wherever your lager is, and you're to use the native auxiliaries and the mounted troops on the flanks. And that's exactly what they do. But the problem is, such is the sheer numbers of Zulus, not only encroaching and driving this force closer and closer to the camp, but also finally the horns of the buffalo meet behind, and therefore it's entirely encircled.
But the Zulus are not using firearms.
They have some firearms, not very effective. Their method is really to fire them once and throw them away. What's interesting is the follow-up battle, which takes place that same day at Rorke's Drift. By that point, they've got a lot of the firearms off the British who they've killed. They kill almost all 1,000 British soldiers at Islamwana to a man and take their weapons. And some of those Martini Henry breech-loading rifles are used by the Zulus at Rorke's Drift.
You mentioned Rorke's Drift. Irrelevant skirmish or great moment of imperial apotheosis?
A little bit of both, but definitely more of the former. Rorke's Drift was very handy for Chelmsford and the British government and the Queen and anyone in authority back in Britain to diminish the impact of Islamwana. So you've got on the one hand this appalling disaster. You've got on the other hand this heroic last stand. Which one are we going to hear more about? Obviously the second one, because by bigging up the second one, you somehow allow the consequences of the former battle, which should have been serious, not only for Chelmsford, who should have been sacked immediately, so incompetent had he been, but also arguably for the British government too, back home, that arguably would have fallen if it hadn't been for Rorke's Drift. So Rorke's Drift's tremendously important. Chelmsford knows this immediately, and he's writing reports exaggerating the significance of Rorke's Drift. Rorke's Drift has saved Natal. That was the argument. Complete nonsense. The Zulu king, Cetshwayo, had given his MPs orders not to cross into Natal for the very good reason that he knew there would be serious consequences as a result of this. Natal was never in danger, but the MP commander, who was actually commanding the force at Islamwana that doesn't actually fight, so this is the reserve at Islamwana, he wants to get on the action. He's seen the destruction of the British army at Islamwana, and he wants a piece of the action himself. He's told that there's this storehouse at Rorke's Drift. Okay, it's across the Buffalo River, but only a few yards. There was never a danger to Natal proper. They want to capture this supply station, basically, and take away some booty. So it's really a relatively insignificant skirmish. That doesn't diminish the extraordinary heroism of a lot of the people involved. I mean, they were really up against it. About 140 soldiers at Rorke's Drift, about 25 of them wounded. So you've only got just over 100 fit soldiers against 3,000 to 4,000 Zulu warriors. But unlike Islamwana, they are in a very effective defensive position, which they've had time to construct because word has come back to them from some of the few survivors at Islamwana that Islamwana has fallen and the Zulus might be on their way.
You mentioned the British government falling. I mean, it was a remarkable time in the 9th century because you had these crumbling imperial frontiers with people like Chelmsford sort of taking it upon themselves to invade its territory. And then the government in London dealing with the consequences, massive political fallout potentially, and governments falling as a result of this.
Yes, in the context of the 19th century, in terms of imperial escapades, needs to be understood, which is that, generally speaking, British governments did not like wars of aggression. They didn't even want to take extra territory for most of the century. What was generally going on is what was the same thing that was happening in South Africa for the Zulu War, which is that local proconsuls and generals were making decisions on their own because they wanted military glory, because they had a security problem they wanted to solve, or perceived a security problem. It was very rarely policy at the centre that was encouraging these imperial escapades. So you could argue that for Disraeli's government to have fallen in 1879 would have been pretty unfair, considering it didn't want the war in the first place. But nevertheless, the war had been fought in its name, and it had been fought incredibly badly.
And then you've got honour. Then, of course, the British flag has been disrespected, so you've got to go and make amends.
Yeah, and Chelmsford's interesting because he's effectively protected by the Queen. He's a former aide-de-camp to Queen Victoria, and she insists that he stays in command for long enough to redeem his honour. And he does that by pretty much disobeying orders, because a replacement is eventually sent out, Wolsey, who's one of the great British soldiers of the 19th century. Wolsey's desperate to get in on the action before it's over, and Chelmsford is desperate to end it before Wolsey arrives. And he manages that by fighting a pretty one-sided battle at Ulundi, which is just outside the Zulu capital, in which he's created a defensive formation, learned all the lessons from Isandlwana, and it's pretty much a bloodbath, a one-sided battle. So he somehow redeems his honour, but certainly not in my eyes. But even as late as me researching and writing this book, you will see a lot of differing accounts about Chelmsford's responsibility and whether or not he got his just desserts. And I certainly don't think he did, because he came back, he was promoted, he was given various honours, he was made Lieutenant Governor of the Tower of London, and he died playing billiards in his club at the age of 78 in 1905. You know, none the worse, really, with his reputation.
Lucky man. What about the Zulus? How hard is it to hear their voice?
It is quite tricky, actually. A lot of the main players died in the war. There was no, of course, tradition of written record in the Zulu culture. It was all oral. But nevertheless, we do have a lot of accounts from some of the Zulus who did survive and fought in the war that were then later on written down by Europeans. This is always a tricky process for a historian to have to decide how accurate they are. Are they telling people what they want to hear? Despite all of that, when you cross-reference what was going on and who was doing what to whom, you can conclude that there are a number of good accounts. There are a number of first-hand accounts of senior Zulu commanders during the Battle of Isandlwana in particular, but also Rorke's Drift and the other battles. And so we do get a little bit of a sense of what the Zulus were trying to achieve and their actual physical experience of battle. I mean, there's some pretty gripping and grim accounts of the Zulus breaking into the camp and finishing off the remaining white soldiers, and they're pulling no punches in their descriptions of what they do.
And Zulu people, after, are they annexed? Are they subjects of Her Majesty the Queen, or is it a sort of a client state setup?
It's complicated. What they initially try and do is not annex Zulu land, but they break it up into separate chieftainships, one of which they allow Cetshwayo, who's originally taken captive and sent down to Cape Town, even visits Britain at one point and meets Queen Victoria. But Cetshwayo goes back and takes control of one of these chieftainships. And this is never going to end well. And of course, they start fighting each other because they've really been set up by the British to do that. And eventually, after a few years of more bloodshed, the whole thing is taken over by the British. So ultimately, it's annexed. That was not the original intention. But of course, they have to do it, I suppose, in the end, just to keep the peace.
Saul David, thank you very much indeed. The book is Zulu. People are still buying it. How many years ago did you write it?
2004. So we're not far off. Well, it's 19, coming up to 20 years now.
You wrote it as a student.
I wish.
I feel the hand of history upon our shoulders.
Hope you enjoyed the podcast. Just before you go, bit of a favour to ask. I totally understand if you don't want to become a subscriber or pay me any cash money.
makes sense. But if you could just do me a favour, it's for free. Go to iTunes or wherever you get your podcast. If you give it a 5-star rating and give it an absolutely glowing review, purge yourself, give it a glowing review. I'd really appreciate that. It's a tough world out there. Law of the jungle out there. And I need all the fire support I can get. So that will boost it up the charts. It's so tiresome. But if you could do it, I'd be very, very grateful. Thank you.
Here's a question for the marketers listening. Want to find that perfect customer beyond the world of scrolling, swiping, and searching? Here's a secret to make sparks fly. Smooth talking with podcast ads. With Acast, you can reach millions of listeners who'll be hanging on your every word. On the train to work, in the gym, or waiting in line for coffee. Start up the conversation with podcast listeners anywhere and everywhere. And they're looking for love. 60% of listeners have a higher trust in brands they've met on podcasts compared to social. Get closer to your audience. Make podcast ads with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Dan Snow's History It. Please follow this show wherever you get your podcasts. It really helps us and you'll be doing us a big favor. Don't forget, you can also listen to all of these podcasts ad-free and watch hundreds of TV documentaries when you subscribe at historyhit.com/subscribe. As a special gift, you can also get your first 3 months for just £1 a month when you use code DANSNOW at checkout.